This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last night belonged to President Obama. The strategy set out by his campaign months ago proved too much for Mitt Romney as swing state after swing state fell into the blue column. For Mitt Romney, the results likely mark the end of a six-year effort to win the White House. For his party, it raises important questions about the Republican identity and the changing face of the American electorate. Florida is still too close to call in the presidential race. One Senate race, North Dakota, a handful of House seats, and the governor's mansions in two states all remain too tight to call. This hour, we'll focus on what happened on the campaign trail, what the candidates did right, what they might have done differently. We'll also look at who turned out to vote and how that changed this election and may shape national elections for years to come. We begin here in Washington with NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Ron, I hope you got some sleep.
Good to see you, Neil.
Yesterday, you and I talked about what a long night it might be, fiercely contested in swing states. As it turned out, if you give President Obama Florida, he's leading there. It's not called yet, but he's leading there. President Obama carried every one of them.
He carried every one of them. If you define the battleground states as eight states, now, of course, some people were still counting North Carolina. Interestingly, the Democratic optimists were still counting North Carolina as a battleground. We had given it to Romney, and it did go, in fact, to Romney. But of the eight that we still called too close to call as of the start of the fighting yesterday, we said, well, if you do call Florida for Obama, and we can't do that right now, but there are a lot of ballots still to be counted. Miami-Dade, then they've got a lot of absentee ballots, and a lot of them are coming in from the military overseas. It's going to take a little while. But all that being said, right now, it looks like it's going to be Obama in Florida, too. So he won all eight.
And toward the end of the campaign, you saw the Romney people trying to expand that map. They went into Pennsylvania. They went into Minnesota. And they said maybe even Michigan.
That's right. Now, check this out as a theory, that they were really trying to keep Bill Clinton out of North Carolina. All right. I've heard this one, that Bill Clinton goes into Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Minnesota to keep those states happy. Or whatever, keep them on board, keep them from falling for the Romney line in the last days. And that kept him out of some other states that they otherwise would have deployed him to. And my guess is Bill Clinton would be the best weapon they could have, aside from the candidate and his wife.
And Bruce Springsteen.
And Bruce Springsteen in the state of North Carolina. I mean, they already had James Taylor at the convention. But my guess is that they probably would have put Bill Clinton in there. Who knows if that would have tipped the state. And Bill probably had a good time visiting all those other states, too.
Also with us here in Studio 3A is Charlie Mattesian, Politico's national politics editor, former editor of the National Journal's Almanac of American Politics. Nice to have you back.
Hi, Neil.
What surprised you yesterday?
Well, I think the breadth of the Obama victory was surprising to me. I didn't expect that he would take the swing states or even the pseudo swing states, the ones that Republicans fainted at. I was surprised at the breadth of that, but I was also surprised that Romney did not do nearly as well as I might have expected in a number of exurbs and suburbs. He did better than John McCain, which really isn't saying that much given the chaos that enveloped that campaign to a certain degree. I mean, it was certainly by almost every metric a better campaign, a better run, better organized campaign, but still it wasn't good enough. He wasn't posting the kind of monster margins in Republican strongholds that he needed to. He wasn't winning the suburbs. He wasn't winning them back. The suburbs that left the party in the 1990s and drifted out of the Republican orbit didn't really come back. A few of them did. A few of them were a lot closer than they've been in recent years. But again, not nearly enough to get him over the top.
And as you're talking, I'm envisioning the state of Virginia.
Virginia is a perfect example. I mean, if you take a look at Northern Virginia, for example, you look at a place like Loudoun County and Prince William County, those are great examples of what's happened to the Republican Party over the last decade or so. Those were Republican strongholds for a number of years, but as they grew more diverse, they began to spiral away from the Republican Party, and that's where you've seen the emergence of this purple state there. But at the same time, even further south, in the Richmond suburbs, Henrico County, another former conservative stronghold, was not a great performing state county for Mitt Romney in the way that it needed to. So, you know, all of these places highlighted the kinds of problems that the Republican Party confronts now as it tries to come up with its next iteration.
That results in Richmond, Ron Elving, in part, it might be attributed to Tim Kaine, the Democratic senatorial candidate. He defeated former Governor Allen yesterday. He is from the Richmond area, used to be mayor of Richmond, so well-known in that area. But you look at the state of Virginia and you see, just as Charlie's describing, it's going to be tough for Republicans to get it back, no?
Well, that's right. Henrico County, which I believe is in the Richmond area and which is a big county for Kaine, came along last night, and that was, I thought, an illustration of how Tim Kaine was a lot better help for Barack Obama in Virginia than he might have had from some of the other candidates that they have looked at in recent years. Tim Kaine, I think, was a real boost for the president, and in a way, the president was a huge boost for Tim Kaine, because one thing that we're going to be talking about for years to come is the efficacy of that turnout operation. They talked about it for years. They talked about how they were going to be even better than they were in 2008, and in many ways, they were. They were good online, which was the hallmark of the 2008 triumph, but they were even better on the ground in 2012, and that, I think, made a huge difference in a lot of places. And, you know, we were talking about suburban counties. I just want to throw a shout-out to a mutual friend of Charlie's and mine, Rhodes Cook, who does definitive work on swing counties in swing states. When he gets through crunching the numbers on this election yesterday, I think he'll be underlining a lot of the points Charlie just made.
Charlie, it's interesting. You look at that electoral map. President Obama carried every state he carried 4 years ago, with the exception of North Carolina, which was very close, and Indiana. Well, that's, a lot of people think, a Republican state. But one of the things that people were talking about 4 years ago is you look at that map, and Republicans have a hard time breaking out. Then 2010 happened, and everybody thought, this map has fundamentally changed. What happened between 2010 and 2012?
Well, two important things happened. Number one, as everyone expected, the electorate was going to be a lot different in 2012 than 2010. But the big question, and this was the question that sort of overshadowed the polling this entire cycle, is what would that model look like? Would it look closer to what Republicans thought it would be in the Romney camp, or would it look closer to the Obama model? And I think it ended up looking a lot closer to the Obama model and what their expectations were. And that has profound implications going forward, meaning we used to talk about maybe two decades ago, maybe even more recently, the idea of a Republican lock on the electoral map. That's gone. Now you have to worry about a Democratic electoral lock, because when you look at the megastates, for example, none of them are in play for the Republicans anymore. They have Texas. But Texas is going sometime. It's just a question of when. Even if you look at another Republican stronghold in recent years, Georgia, that's a state, again, the demographics are working against the Republican Party. So all of a sudden, you've got an electoral map every 4 years where California, Illinois, New York are locked in. That's a lot of electoral votes. Those are locked into the Democratic Party. The only mega state that Republicans have now is Texas. And at some point, it's just a matter of when that's moving away from the party, too, if it continues down the same path.
Let me look at another part of that map, Ron Elving. You've got the blue Northeast. You've got the blue West Coast. And Democrats say, sooner rather than later, Arizona is going to be in play. They've already got New Mexico, and it looks increasingly like Nevada and Colorado.
It does not seem like that long ago to some of us that California was the bedrock of every Republican majority in presidential elections. You started by giving them the big kahuna. You gave them the biggest, most populous state, rather, in the country just to begin with. Now, part of that was Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon, who were Californians and who were heading up the ticket in a lot of those elections. But it wasn't just that. It was the whole demographics of the state.
Orange County.
Orange County was famous, of course, for being a Republican hotbed. Well, go look at Orange County today. It's largely Asian American, Hispanic American. Lots of Filipinos live there. Lots of the people who live there are lesser income, or at least not certainly rich people, who are Anglos who have moved there. And it is not the bedroom community, the series of beach communities, you know, towns that have the name beach in them, that it was at one time. And much of that, of course, was always a bit of a fantasy. But Southern California is not what it was. San Diego is a metropolitan area, not nearly what it was. And the northern part of the state has become part of this ecotopia of the Pacific Northwest, more in common with Oregon and Washington in many ways than it has with Southern California. And then, of course, big bottom line, most important, since the 1994 turnaround in the attitude of the Republican Party and their anti-immigration stance that they took in that 1994 referendum, the party has lost Hispanics largely in California for a generation, and that's what's really the biggest engine making California go the other way. And then that spreads across the country, one state after another. You know, Washington, Oregon, California now are kind of a block. You're adding Nevada pretty consistently as the Hispanic vote grows in Arizona. Arizona would be part of that. New Mexico is already part of that. And then that heels right up to West Texas and on into the new Texas Charlie was talking about, 2020 at least. Maybe even 2016, Texas becomes competitive.
And Charlie, just talking about that immigration issue, would you expect that somehow President Obama could arrange to have a new version of the DREAM Act on the floor of Congress tomorrow?
I think it's possible. I mean, I think some of the claims...
Congress isn't sitting tomorrow.
Yeah,
no, next Tuesday, Congress comes back.
I think the claims of the administration to make widespread sweeping changes are a little bit overstated. And obviously, you know, they were playing to the base there and the need to win over Hispanics. You know, I don't know that it's going to be entirely more... there's going to be a more greased path than there was in the past. But... It's an issue that Republicans have to grapple with one way or another. And Orange County is a great example of why. Orange County used to be called the most conservative place on earth, and Ronald Reagan once said that that's the place where Republicans go to die. No longer. That's not the place. And the scary thing for Republicans, and if you're a Republican public official, is you have to think it's not just a Latino problem. It's also an Asian problem. And when you take a look at some of the immigrant groups that used to vote Republican, Vietnamese Americans, Cuban Americans, the second generation is also moving away from the Republican Party. And the margins are much more decreased. And so that is a messaging problem. That's a bigger problem and something that still hasn't been addressed and has to be hammered out very quickly.
And the African-American minority that turned out in such spectacular numbers for Barack Obama, not only 4 years ago, but again yesterday, Ron Elving, well, that's the percentages may be unique to this particular candidate, but the rock-solid support for the Democratic Party, that is persistent.
It's 13% of the electorate. In yesterday's vote, it was 13% in 2008. It actually went a little less for Barack Obama than it did in 2008 by 2 percentage points. It dropped just slightly, and that was African-American men. Some African-American men were disillusioned with the president or for one reason or another voted against him. The African-American women stayed with him. But just to that point about Asians that Charlie just made, the Asian portion of the electorate, only 3%. Very, very small still. However, it was 73% for Obama. That was up 11 points since 2008 and his biggest increase in any demographic identifiable group.
President Obama picked up more than 300 electoral votes last night, well over the 270 he needed. We're talking with NPR's Ron Elving and Politico's Charlie Mattesian the day after. Up next, some of the lessons of the campaign. Now that we know more about who voted and why, we'll talk with Republican strategist Matt Schlapp. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Special Coverage from NPR News. This is Special Coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. After the election results last night, leaders from around the world reacted to the re-election of President Barack Obama. Many expressed their own hopes for what this might mean for foreign policy. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, "I will continue to work with President Obama to preserve the strategic interests of Israel's citizens." British Prime Minister David Cameron, on a visit to Syrian refugees on the Jordanian border, said, "One of the first things I want to talk to Barack about is how we must do more to try to solve this crisis in Syria. Above all, congratulations to Barack. I've enjoyed working with him. I think he's a very successful U.S. president and look forward to working with him in the future." And from French President François Hollande, "Your re-election is a clear choice in favor of an America that is open, unified, completely engaged in the international scene and conscious of the challenges facing our planet, peace, the economy, and the environment." We're talking this hour about not only what happened last night, but why and what that means for the futures of both parties. With us here in the studio, NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving, also Charlie Mattesian, the National Politics Editor at Politico, and let me introduce Matt Schlapp, the founder of Cove Strategies, a political consulting firm. He served as political director for President George W. Bush. And Matt, nice to have you back.
Great to be here.
And as a political tactician on the ground, looking back, what might Mitt Romney have done differently?
He might have found a way to get President Obama's job approval rating to be a little bit lower. When you sit back and look at elections, a lot of times it comes down to some very basic facts. And every day when I got up in the morning, I'd look at the approval ratings of President Obama. And for much of the year, they hovered in the mid-40s. And that's a danger zone for an incumbent. President George W. Bush, the president I served, was right about at 49%. When it came to election, to his re-election in 2004.
And that was a close run thing.
That was a close one, won by about 3 points. The last job approval rating I looked at before Election Day or on Election Day had him at 51, 52. Boy, it's going to be, I think, next to impossible to beat a president with that kind of approval rating.
This was not for lack of effort, however. The numbers of negative ads that right. were airing, people were buried under them.
Well, this gets to another question, which is, yes, there was an attempt to bring those numbers down through an assortment of negative television advertising on both sides.
Yeah.
But one of the things that smart people are going to sit back and look at this election with the inundation of money spent on television is to the utility of spending that much money. The outside groups, the campaigns, the committees, they still are trying to win the old-fashioned way, at least on my side, and that's by spending a lion's share of their money on television. And I think the one thing we have to, as my party has to do, is look inside and say, okay, what does Obama seem to get right on the ground? His support seems to grow between those final polls and what happens on Election Day. They seem to optimize with what they have on the ground. It's old-fashioned. It's organizing neighborhoods. They seem to do it well. I think we talk a good game that we think we're doing it, but I think they're beating us on the ground.
You said when you were with us last time, a good ground game worth a field goal, 3 points.
Yeah, that was your statement. And I agreed with it.
Oh, okay.
And I do agree with it. And that usually what we usually refer to as ground game is those kind of activities at the end, knocking on doors to make sure people follow up and go to vote. They know it's Election Day. Maybe giving them transportation to the polls. Those are the types of things we usually refer to as a ground game. I think what President Obama has done so well is he's greatly expanded that. He's started earlier. He's communicating to people at their front door earlier in the process.
And as you look at this, the amount of sophistication, you said it's the old-fashioned approach, but
right.
a sophisticated effort in that old-fashioned approach. They had lists of databases that they would go into and knew who was in each district.
Right. I guess one of the things I have to be careful about today is looking like I'm being overly critical to my team. But I think in fairness, I think you have to give the Obama team credit for also really mining data and really having a data system that gave them very detailed information about the types of people they'd be targeting. Because if you look at the coalition, despite 4 years of some rather controversial decisions, although reliably liberal for his base, he was able to hold together a coalition, grow support amongst Hispanics, the youth vote. You look at the base elements of his support with all the almost, from a Republican standpoint, it almost seemed like hysteria in 2008. They kept it going. And if you look at these exit polls and if you believe them, they kind of kept that together. And I think one of the reasons they did is they had good tactics. And the great thing about politics is that you really only get a great tactic once that's only yours, because usually the other side gets smart enough to copy it. I hope we can do that.
Well, and that's just what I was going to ask Charlie Mattesian. Is this a tactic, this operation, is this something unique to Barack Obama and this set of political operators, or is this inherited by the Democratic Party and indeed then copied by the Republican Party?
Well, I think in many ways all of these ground game organizations are derivative in some way. I mean, Obama built on the gains, the online gains that Howard Dean pioneered in some way. But I mean, it is original to the Obama campaign in many ways. And I think you could have made an argument that, well, 2008 was sort of, you know, catching lightning in a bottle, but now they've done it twice. And so the cockiness that team had, you know, well, now they can spike the football. They can do a little trash talking. They've done it twice now and done it differently each time. I mean, this was a very tough lift, and it was a very different kind of campaign. It wasn't hope and change anymore. It was scorched earth on the opponent, and it was also squeezing out, maxing out the base, which is a sort of different kind of campaign than they ran. So they've run two fantastic campaigns, and so, yeah, everyone's going to look to it and sort of mine it for any kind of detail they can get.
Ron?
I would put in, too, the possibility that in all of this, you need something special from the candidate, and that something special in 2008 we've all talked about. But in 2012, it wasn't the same. We had a tremendous drop-off, in fact, among some of these groups. They were great at getting out the people under 30 years old, but they dropped by 6 points in their support of the president. Turns out it was enough. You know, better dropping by six than not having them show up to vote. They got enough out of a lot of their support groups, probably because in the end there was enough residual belief in Barack Obama, even after 4 years of what many people, even who were voting for him yesterday, called disappointment. But they also still had a guy they could put out in a moment to give a speech, to give a performance, to conduct a campaign. And it was a very vigorous campaign for an incumbent president. And somebody who still stood for something that meant enough to enough of the people in this coalition that they would actually go out and do all this work. Not all the work, not even most of the work, was done by people who were being paid. Most of it was being done by volunteers. Lots of people who were themselves professionals, people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, who were going out and spending long days and nights working on this campaign. There was something inspiring them to do that other than money and other than just us versus them.
Matt Schlapp, we used to, when all of us were much younger, speak of the New Deal coalition that Democrats were able to do, and at a time when they were considered the natural party of government. That came unraveled due to any number of things, the realignment of the South following the Civil Rights Movement, the Ronald Reagan Revolution. It looked like the Democrats were in the wilderness. Is this a durable Democratic coalition?
I don't know. It's a great question, because I think somehow the phenomenon of Barack Obama is somewhat unhinged from these statistics in the economy and some of these problems that our country faces. He seems to be able to overcome, you know, what is an historically very high unemployment rate, you know, debt that's been racked up, economic insecurity, international problems in Libya. You look over and over again. He even seems to get through a storm with some pretty good ink, which us Republicans never seem to be able to get.
Well, Chris Christie did okay.
He did okay. I'll say this: he sure took care of himself. if you look at all that, Obama is a little unhinged from what other presidents face when they have rough times. He might just be a unique historical figure, first black elected president. I think smart people are going to have to sit and look at that. Can that be handed off to any Democrat coming up behind him? I don't know. The one thing I'll say, and I agree with much of what you said on this show, including in earlier segments, but the thing you got to remember about politics is these states are always changing. You guys talked about Texas. Things are always changing. And not everything's changing their way. Things will also change back to the conservative way and to the Republican way. This great Hispanic problem that we have as a party is also a great opportunity. If we play it right as a party, Democrats are going to find themselves with cleavages between some of their support groups. So the one thing I can say is, like, the coalitions and politics are like a mighty ocean, and they're moving up and they're moving down. And smart operatives make sure that the party makes good decisions to make sure it grows.
Well, then, given that, if you were being called up by somebody's campaign to say, 4 years, we want to get going, what would you say we need to do first?
The Republican Party, in order to not have evenings like we all on my side had last night, where we cried in some beer cups, the first thing we need to do is make sure that we look at what Obama did well. And, you know, outside groups on the conservative and Republican side raised, by their own bragging, $500 or $600 million, $500 million, maybe over $500 million, and spent it. So it's hard for my side to then complain that there was some kind of asymmetry on spending money.
There was 4 years ago, not this year.
They did a great job. My side did a great job of scratching and clawing and raising that money. The question is, did we do the right things with it? Was spending the lion's share of that on a bunch of television advertising in kind of the traditional sense the right way to do it? Should they have invested in some infrastructure that would be enduring? And so I think that's the first question. The second question is, I think you have to get right into Hispanic support. What George W. Bush did with Hispanics, because he understood it from Texas and his brother understood it being from Florida, is it's the biggest growing demographic that we have the best chance of partnering with. And we've done the worst job of trying to court them. And I think that is a great, like I said earlier, it's an opportunity for our party. But it is also, you know, we can talk about building a wall along our southern border, and they can talk about building a wall between a Republican and getting the keys to the Oval Office. It's simple math. It's also just the right thing to do as a party. I don't want to be known as the party just of one racial demographic. I want to be involved with a party that reaches out to everyone. It's the right thing to do. We all know that's the case. What happened with African Americans in the Republican Party is not a history we should be proud of or want to repeat.
Ron Elving, it's interesting. You can look at everything that Matt Schlapp just said and said, well, that makes sense. Convincing the people in the party to publicly endorse those views in terms of votes and policy, That's something else again.
Yes, it will be, and that is a great challenge, but that is the kind of challenge that both of the nation's historic great parties have overcome a number of times in their histories. They've had their ups and downs, to put it another way. And they've usually come back in some creative way, or at least in some imaginative way, to readdress those problems, as Matt suggests, and come up with new means to do it. But the other way that they do it, the way that really makes it ultimately succeed, is they find new faces. They find new candidates. 10 years ago, I wager none of us in this room had heard of Barack Obama. If we had, we probably chuckled something about, well, that guy's got no kind of a political career with a name like that. Not when we all know about Osama bin Laden, a mistake that people still make. And so we would have all dismissed him 10 years ago. And I dare say at one time, a lot of people were dismissing Ronald Reagan back in the 60s and 70s when he got into politics. People were always writing his political obituary long before 1980. So it's new faces. It's people who come along at the right time, who have the right people around them, who have the right message, who then take the party into new places with them. And it's the individual personality that has that magic moment that makes that happen.
Well, finding those people, that sounds great, too. That's not easy. You look around at the party. You made a joke about Chris Christie. Certainly helped himself. He reached out across party lines after the storm and helped Barack Obama. No question about that. He is very popular in the state of New Jersey. Yeah. If you could have a Republican from a state like New Jersey, well, now there's something to conjure with.
Well, we just tried that. His name was Mitt Romney, and he's from Massachusetts. And
once again, he didn't come with a base in Massachusetts.
Well, I guess I'll say I don't think our problem in this presidential election cycle was the candidate. I actually think Mitt Romney really stepped up when he needed to, did a great job at the convention. He executed flawlessly at that first debate. That might be one of the best debates in the history of our country, at least in the modern age. So it's going to be hard for me to be critical of him. But I think we do have the faces out there. I think we do have the people. The one thing I think is really important, and I want to make this point, it's not about, as a Republican, I don't believe my party needs to moderate. I don't think reaching out to Hispanics means that we have to be less of a conservative party. We are a center-right party. But what it means is that we explain to Hispanics what we want to do for small businesses, what we believe makes strong families, what we believe makes safe communities. And also, we're conservatives. We believe that the immigration system is completely broken and government has screwed this up. If Republicans can go out on the stump and talk about how the IRS is broken and talk about how government screws things up, Hispanics in this country understand what's wrong with the immigration government services that they have to deal with, and it's broken, and we ought to fix it. That's where we need a Mr. Fix-It, right? So there are all types of messages that are consistent with our conservative ideology, and when it comes to people like Marco Rubio or Governor Susana Martinez or Ted Cruz, who was just elected in Texas, we are going to have a treasure trove of wonderful talent to choose from.
Charlie Mattesian, Barack Obama has achieved something very significant in transforming the Democratic Party and its electoral outlook, but, well, he's a lame duck. He's not going to run again.
Right. I mean, and that brings up the sort of the talent pipeline issue here, and that's something that Matt sort of hinted at, which is that when you take a look at 2016, for example, and who's in the Republican pipeline, well, you know, you could make a pretty good argument that a Hispanic candidate for the national ticket is much more likely to come out of the Republican Party at this point than it is the Democratic Party. If you take a look at the trajectories and who has what talent, you're talking about Martinez in New Mexico, Sandoval in Nevada. You've got all sorts of folks, Marco Rubio, who are positioned to get there sooner than in the Democratic Party, because many of the most there are many more Hispanic office holders in among Democrats in Congress, but they're not positioned to make the national ticket. They can't play broadly the same way the Republican officials can. At the same time, the challenge, and this is something that Matt underscored, then is that hollow core, which is it doesn't matter if you have a roster of pretty talented Hispanic officials running states or in the Senate. You know, adding Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio. It doesn't really matter if you're losing the Hispanic vote 70 to 20 or, you know, 75 to 25. So that's the challenge. Yesterday was a very bad day, not only when you look at the exit polls, but also if you take a look at who lost for the Republican Party. Think about this. There was Mia Love, an African-American candidate in Utah. It should have been a priority. There's no way she should have lost that, the opportunity to elect the first black congresswoman as a Republican. Alan West is now trailing an African-American Republican in Florida, Maldonado in California in a House race, an opportunity to elect another Hispanic Republican, a talented one. Those were individuals who had to be elected, and the Republican Party fell short there, and they need to take on every one of those opportunities and win those. And
we lost to Hispanic incumbents as well.
Right, in Texas.
And in Florida.
Yeah. Right.
And you also look at some of the Senate races, Matt Schlapp, that might have been looked winnable for Republicans, might have looked easy for Republicans, and turned out to be in the Democratic camp. And you think of, well, Maine, for one, Olympia Snowe retired, and then you had Indiana and Missouri.
Just when I was able to start smiling today and start to feel a little better, you had to really go right there. Yeah. The Senate landscape for a partisan Republican like myself can't be more disappointing to think back on the opportunities. You had candidates that literally shot themselves in the foot and other places and lost races that they really should have won. And we had some really wonderful candidates. You think of Linda Lingle in Hawaii and Heather Wilson in New Mexico. Those are awfully tough states. They both gave it a great go. That New Mexico seat was a lot closer than could have been imagined. But, you know, a year ago, the types of pickups that Republicans were talking about and what you actually saw happen, and I know we have at least one race that's still to be determined.
North Dakota.
Yeah, you can't help but be very, very disappointed. Matter even in that North Dakota race, most Republicans 3 months ago were just putting that on the definite column. And you can see in politics you should never, ever do that because there's always something that can happen.
So tomorrow you're going to found the Matt Schlapp Data Mining Institute?
Well, I've tried that once. When it comes to politics, it's about basics. It's not just about three television channels on a black and white television anymore. People get their information a lot of great ways, including NPR and this radio show. They're getting a lot of things on the net. Politico's done a lot of innovative new things. We ought to innovate like all these media companies are innovating.
Matt Schlapp, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Matt Schlapp, the founder of Cove Strategies, a political consulting firm, served as political director for President George W. Bush. Staying with us is NPR Washington senior editor Ron Elving and Politico's political editor Charlie Mattesian. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Exit polls yesterday show that unemployment and the economy were by far the biggest issues on voters' minds. The Obama campaign performed better in cities, Governor Romney in suburbs and rural areas. Men were most likely to support Mitt Romney, women to support President Obama. The divide by race and ethnicity even more stark. More about what those numbers tell us in a moment. Our guests are Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor, and Charlie Mattesian, national politics editor at Politico. Arturo Vargas is executive director of the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials. He joins us on the phone from his office in Los Angeles. Good of you to be with us.
Good afternoon.
And tell us about how the Latino vote broke for President Obama, about 75-25, looks like.
That's exactly right. We participated in a election eve poll of more than about 5,000 Latino registered voters in a number of states across the country, and consistently the president received about 75% support from Latino voters, making it a decisive element of his victory coalition last night.
And did you ask those voters why?
We did ask those voters why, and interestingly, voters were motivated not simply to just support the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, but there was a significant share of Latino voters who indicated they were voting to support the Latino community. And that's something we've seen consistently among Latino voters, that Latinos do not see voting as an act of, as an individual act or complying with their civic duty, but something they do on behalf of their community. And we know that Latinos have suffered greatly from this recession, and I think many of them have probably were turned out to vote in order to try to address the economic ills in the community, as well as trying to see if we can finally achieve comprehensive immigration reform.
There are some in the Republican Party, and we were just hearing from Matt Schlapp, a Republican strategist, saying, wait a minute, on so many of those issues you just described, we ought to get a good percentage, maybe even a majority of Latinos voting Republican.
Well, in fact, there are hundreds of thousands of Latinos, I think, who are eager to be welcomed into the Republican Party because they share many of the views on business, and they're entrepreneurs and they're fiscal conservatives. But unfortunately, some of the messages from the Republican Party on issues such as immigration reform and the role of immigrants in the country has really alienated many Latinos across the country. We saw that in the 90s in California. We saw that over the past couple of years in Arizona, some of the other states that have passed pernicious anti-immigrant legislation, I think to the detriment of the Republican Party being able to bring in Latinos into the fold of their tent.
And does this become a, if you will, genetic story as these people vote Democratic? Do you think, continue to vote Democratic?
Well, Latino voters have demonstrated that they are not just Democrats, that they are a swing electorate. We know that George W. Bush was able to get a substantial share of the Latino vote in 2000 and 2004. And that was because I think George W. Bush understood Latinos and the optimism they come to this country and the faith they have and the patriotism they have in the United States. I think if Republican strategists were able to return to that approach to reaching Latino voters, it could do much better than they did yesterday.
Do you think it would have made a difference had, for example, Marco Rubio been the vice presidential nominee instead of Paul Ryan?
Well, it could possibly have made a difference, but again, what we know of Latino voters is that they don't necessarily vote last names either. Latinos voters have demonstrated time and time again that they look at candidates and campaigns and the circumstances of particular elections. They do not vote straight party lines, and they do not vote just the last name of a candidate. In this election, I think what was on the table for Latino voters was the need to move the economy, but also wanting to see some movement on immigration reform and on education as well.
Ron Elving, let me bring that point back. We're just talking with Arturo Vargas here, and he says, you look back at the Republican primary campaign where Mitt Romney differentiated himself from the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, by outflanking him on the right on immigration issues. This was bedrock Republican policy. You saw, as he mentioned, George W. Bush get significant support from the Latino community in his first election campaign, primarily because he was talking about immigration reform, reforms that were scuppered by his own party. You saw a John McCain, a supporter of immigration reform, change his policies 180 degrees when he got into a tight primary race in Arizona.
That's right. And George W. Bush's brother, Jeb Bush, in Florida has also been an exemplar of the other attitude entirely towards Hispanics and other immigrants as well. What you saw in the primaries was Rick Perry bringing a Texas attitude like W's and to some degree like Jeb's to the primaries and saying, look, folks, this is where we need to be. This isn't where we need to go. He says, this is my heart. I see people coming to this country for opportunity. We need to be the party of opportunity. And immediately he was pounced on by about half the field, but not the entire field. Newt Gingrich took a position that was a little later on in the primaries, a little bit more like Rick Perry's, but not Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney's people had decided he had enough exposures with respect to health care, with respect to past policies on social issues like abortion and gay marriage, that he had to be tough on this one. And by being tough, what they meant was he had to appeal to what's considered the hardcore base of people in the Republican Party that are anti-illegal immigration and give off the impression or the vibe to an awful lot of people that, you know, they're just really not all that happy about all of these people coming to the United States in any event, legally or illegally. And certainly they are against any of these people being incorporated into the society unless they're willing to take a second degree citizenship and not vote. All right, that may be a mischaracterization of much of the Republican Party, but there are some votes out there. Tom Tancredo had some support, some others. And that was the group to which Mitt was appealing, and I don't know that his people can really deny it, when he used the phrase self-deportation. Maybe a lot of people are just going to leave this country because there isn't as much economic magnet here as there used to be. Well, that denies the whole idea of opportunity. That undercuts the whole Republican message of opportunity that was so successful for the Bushes or for Rick Perry in the days when he was a rising political star.
Charlie?
Well, I think there are two important points to make when talking about the Latino vote. The Republicans don't have to win the Latino vote. They just have to not get obliterated. And that's an important point to make. Right now, 75-25 is just a landslide margin that's impossible to overcome. And the other point to make is that Republicans don't have to change the core values of their party or their message. What they do need to do is take some steps to alter the tone, to make a better communication, to recognize the sort of the uphill challenge they have and speak in a different tone, reach out in a very different kind of way that reaches Latinos, because there, like Matt said, there are so many opportunities there. One of the stories of American immigrant groups, at least most of them, if you take a look over time, as they achieve a foothold in American society, they begin to lose their moorings from the party they first started in. And that's certainly within the realm of possibilities with Latinos, but not as long as you have the tone of the debate and in the direction that many Republicans have taken.
Arturo Vargas, you represent the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials. There are more than a few of those who are, of course, Republican, and we've been talking about some of those. As you speak with them, how do they tell you they might go ahead and change the tone that Charlie Mattesi was just talking about?
Well, I think many of them are actually supportive of voices in the Republican Party, like former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, former Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez, who had been trying to moderate the party's position on immigration reform and its approach to immigrants, and to bring the party back to where it was a decade ago on this issue. Many of them are eager to try to develop a Republican Party that, in fact, is welcoming to many more Latinos who share the party's conservative fiscal views and support of business and entrepreneurs. I think that many of them are frustrated where the party is now, and I'm hoping that this election could maybe give those voices some new impetus to have a conversation within the party, so that that party could actually not destine itself to be a party of the minority by excluding Latinos.
And Arturo Vargas, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Arturo Vargas, Executive Director of the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, with us on the phone from his office in Los Angeles. Andra Gillespie is political science professor at Emory University, a former analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman, and she joins us from Emory's campus in Atlanta. Good of you to be with us.
Thank you for having me.
And as you look at the exit polls, President Obama did well among women again.
This isn't terribly surprising. We've seen a gender gap in American politics since 1980. It narrowed in 2004, and it started to widen again in 2008 and 2012 as well. The thing that's really interesting about the gender gap this time around is that there is a gender gap across racial groups. And in fact, the gender gap between black men and women and Latino men and women was actually wider than it was among white men and women.
So that it is something that is to what do you attribute that?
So it's going to take us a long time to figure this out, because this is actually a pretty new development. It could be that the significance of women's reproductive issues, and particularly contraception, may have resonated more with women of color. For what reason, we're not 100% sure. At this point, it's going to take us a long time to be able to examine that. It could also be that, in particular, looking at African-American men, that they were either compelled by social conservatism or that they were really disheartened by President Obama's performance with respect to the economy, and they ended up penalizing him by being more likely to vote for Mitt Romney.
Might his decision to come out in support of gay marriage, might that have played a factor?
It's going to be really hard for us to tell. From what we can gather, from what we see anecdotally, it seems like that had a very negligible impact overall on the vote. I mean, we see that President Obama's support overall dropped by about 2 percentage points, but we would need to tease this out. And unfortunately, the exit poll data, when they first publish it, they talk about white evangelicals. They really don't look at African-American evangelicals in particular.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Kelly Goff, political correspondent for The Root, also author of Party Crashing, How the Hip-Hop Generation Declared Political Independence. And she joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to speak with you again.
It's always great to come back.
And Kelly Goff, we want to talk to you about the youth vote in just a minute, but I also wanted to ask you about this African-American male-female issue.
Well, I will quote a friend and a fabulous source, Cornell Belcher, who is an Obama campaign pollster and former head pollster for the Democratic National Committee. And he once said to me, when I was interviewing him for Party Crashing, which was about the next generation of black voters, he said that if it weren't for church-going black women, the Democratic Party would have been in trouble a long time ago. And I thought that was kind of an apt way of describing the importance of African-American female voters specifically to the Democratic base. excuse me, and with particular regards to President Obama, I mean, you all already know this, but for your listeners who may not, African-American women last election cycle, for the first time in American history, were the highest turning out demographic of voters. So that, I think, sort of sets up a bit of a gender gap just going into the equation. I will say I would not be surprised, however, when you go back and look at some of the data, that gay marriage actually, this might be one of the few instances where it did have a more than negligible impact. I'll be interested when we see the breakdown. And I say that for two reasons. Number one, because I wrote a column where I interviewed Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, who's chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, who is also an ordained minister. And when I asked him, you know, do you anticipate the gay marriage issue costing President Obama with black voters, he was really one of the first high-profile African-Americans who supports the president, doesn't have an axe to grind, you know, was planning on voting for him, et cetera, who said quite candidly, of course it will. Now, it's not going to be significant, but he said, absolutely, there are some black voters who will not vote for him. I have to be honest, I'm not, you know, proud of saying this because people know my own stance on this issue. There's people in my family who I know felt that way. Right. So, you know, and I'm saying that they're male. That's my point. Mm-hmm. So I do think that when we actually start parsing some of this data, that issue actually might rear its head more specifically with this very small demographic than perhaps it showed up in the larger context of the election.
Andra Gillespie, it'll be interesting in that regard to look at some of these numbers coming out of the state of Maryland, and not a state that's in play in presidential politics, but gay marriage was on the ballot there. This is a very large percentage of the vote in Maryland, especially the Democratic vote, is African-American.
Well, I mean, the fact that the gay marriage amendment passes in Maryland with a state that's 30% African-American and this demographic is overwhelmingly Democratic in that state suggests the negligibility of gay marriage. Even for people who personally disagree with the concept of gay marriage, there are other issues that would be more important. So if you disagreed with the budget-cutting plans that Paul Ryan proposed, if you disagreed with Mitt Romney's tax proposal, then you might actually sublimate your perception of gay marriage and your opinion about that in favor of your more economically based feelings about the economy and about both candidates. Also, you know, there were definitely ministers who called for African Americans to not turn out and vote in this election to sort of show their disapproval of what President Obama did in endorsing gay marriage. But African American voters have a history of being independent. I mean, people thought that President George W. Bush's faith-based initiative was going to be one of those moments where we were going to see this uptick in African-American support for George W. Bush. And we see it between 2000 and 2004, but it's a 2 percentage point difference. So we don't see this overwhelming shift. I think it's an economic argument that's probably more likely to explain the differences between black men and black women. And in addition, you know, I do my research on young African-American leaders. Oftentimes, young deracialized leaders like President Obama encounter difficulties, particularly among older men in their communities. And so if these men don't feel that President Obama has done enough with respect to African Americans or done enough with respect to race, then they may be the most fickle sort of within the segment of the African American population, and they may have been less likely to turn out and vote. So I'm not saying that there weren't some people who didn't vote for Obama because of gay marriage, but there were probably other reasons that were more important in explaining that difference.
Kelly Goff, I wanted to ask you specifically also about the youth vote, and that's one of the things that you specialize in as well. And the Obama campaign made enormous efforts to turn out young people campaigning on campuses in the swing states, particularly in places like Ohio and Iowa. And they turned out, as Ron Elving was telling us, the exit poll suggests they did not support him quite as strongly as they did 4 years ago, but they turned out.
They did. And in fact, the data from Circle, which is one of the organizations which specializes specifically in analyzing the youth vote, there was about a 1% uptick actually in turnout among 18 to 29-year-olds, which was not what was really anticipated. Last night I interviewed Valicia Butterfield Jones, who is the National Youth Vote Director for the Obama campaign, and I asked her if she was surprised, and she said absolutely not. She said she never bought into the whole media narrative that had been sort of in play for the last 6 months or so, that there was this huge enthusiasm gap among young voters that was really going to cost Obama at the voting booth. She said she never bought it because she was seeing on the ground what was happening. And in addition to the turnout among young voters at the polls, which she said really made the difference in places like Ohio and Virginia, she said that really the growth in their young volunteers is actually what convinced her that there wasn't this enthusiasm gap and that the media was kind of getting the coverage wrong. Because she said that their ground game, which most of your experts I've heard on your show today have acknowledged is really what made the difference in this election, she said what kind of has gotten missed in this story is that those were mainly young people. A lot of the people who were for building the foundation for the ground game, the grassroots operation that started more than a year ago, she said those were all young volunteers. And so, you know, she said that the story about young people sort of falling out of love with the president, you know, it's like any marriage, right? It may not be quite as hot and heavy as it is in the honeymoon phase, but they weren't going anywhere is kind of the her point. And so she wasn't surprised, actually, at how well they ended up doing.
We just have about a minute left, but as you look back on it, what might Mitt Romney have done to cut into that support?
Well, sorry.
Go ahead.
Do you mind if I... Well, no, actually, he did cut into the support amongst 18 to 29-year-olds, particularly white 18 to 29-year-olds. Mitt Romney actually wins among that demographic. So probably some of the uptick were young Republicans who maybe didn't feel like they could turn out and vote against Barack Obama in 2008, who have now come of age and are now much more comfortable identifying themselves as conservatives and as Republicans. But I think it's actually really interesting to see that white voters across the board, regardless of their age category, supported Mitt Romney at higher numbers than Barack Obama. This suggests that we have racial polarization that we're going to really have to deal with as a country.
Well, this will be the most racially polarized election in more than two decades. But we know which way the country's trending, and it's with minorities becoming the fastest growing voting demographic. So Republicans will have to get on board or not, or be left out of the game.
Kelly Goff, political correspondent for The Root. Andra Gillespie, political science professor at Emory University. Thanks very much to you both.
Thank you.
Our thanks as well to Charlie Mattesian of Politico, where he's national politics editor, and to NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving, who were with us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.